This is the Politics Show at the University of Reading. I'm your host, Tariq Ahmed, and we have an exciting show for you today with a special documentary on the future of security following tensions rising between Russia and Ukraine. We'll also be introducing a new segment called Borisgate, where Ashley Abludon updates you on the Prime Minister's current position. Will he stay or will he go? Annalise Wicks will be discussing all things post-graduation and how you can prepare to enter the job market following the completion of your degree. Kit Clayton gives us the lowdown on everything going on in and around Reading, and we'll be asking the age-old question, how's your New Year's resolutions going? Are you sticking to them, or are you already thinking about 2023? All of this and more on The Politics Show at the University of Reading, but first, it's the headlines with Ashley Bluedawn and Kit Clayton.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has broken his public silence on the standoff between Moscow and the West over Ukraine. He claimed that the US and its allies did not meet his security demands. On Wednesday, the US president approved the deployment of US troops to Eastern Europe. A Ukrainian student studying at the University of Reading has said that her and her friends in Ukraine are now fearing for their safety as Russian troops surround the country's borders.
The Ukrainians, they are thinking about the possibility of war. I know some people in Ukraine which now get money only in dollars.
Four of the Prime Minister's most senior advisers, including his Chief of Staff, have resigned. This comes amid calls for the PM's resignation over his breach of his own COVID rules. Critics say, considering Tobias Elwood's most recent letter to the 1922 committee, that Boris Johnson is running his last hour. However, Johnson continues his premiership, declaring he will lead the UK until 2029.
We are less than 3 weeks away from the Reading University Student Union elections. All four of the full-time roles, including the position of student union president, will be up for grabs, along with 11 part-time positions. But the diversity officer role has been renamed to the inclusion and communities officer position. You can no longer nominate yourself. However, candidates have until the 11th of February to submit their manifestos before the polls open on the 22nd of February until the 25th.
Northern Ireland sees First Minister Paul Given resign surrounding UK's of UK-NI border checks. This country also awaits Deputy First Minister Michelle O'Neill to resign, as this triggers power-sharing agreement consequences. Stormont ministers will carry on their positions until elections in May. University and College Union announce more workouts while university staff negotiate pension pay. It's said that 50,000 members shall walk out from the 14th of Feb to the 22nd. But for Reading Uni staff, Reading Week walkouts may go unnoticed, as this leaves them with only 2 days of impeding industrial action.
A new study has found that consumers don't actually want help when it comes to sticking to New Year's resolutions. Despite an array of different products and services which aim to help you stick to your New Year's goals, such as planners and accountability apps, it all essentially boils down to self-control, according to researchers, but also spontaneity. Apparently, we don't like sticking to the same thing for a long time, and we like a bit of flexibility. Who would have guessed?
In good news, the Winter Olympics opens today. Hopes are Team GB will see some medals in the bobsleigh, skeleton, or the skiing. GB also stands a good chance of getting a winning team as England, Wales, and Scotland kick off for the Six Nations on Saturday. Leaving Italy and others fighting for the wooden spoon, you should tune in ITV and BBC or bring your support to Park Bar.
Those were the headlines by Ashley Bluedawn and Kit Clayton. Well, we spoke there about the ongoing developments in Eastern Europe as Russian troops continue to surround the Ukrainian border. Questions of security have emerged and are now at the centre of international debate. But what we wanted to find out was what's really going on in Eastern Europe. How did we get to this position? What impact could this have on the security of the West and for the rest of the international community? And finally, are you appropriately concerned? Are you appropriately informed? All of these questions and more answered in this exclusive documentary, Is Our Security at Risk?
On the 9th of November 1989, as the Cold War began to thaw across Eastern Europe, the spokesman for East Berlin's Communist Party announced a change in his city's relations with the West. Starting at midnight that day, he said, citizens of the GDR were free to cross the country's borders. This signalled the beginning of the end of the Cold War. While some saw it as a victory for the West and an annihilation of communist ideology, many believe that Russia would once again arise from the ruins, as they always have. And rise from the ruins they did, particularly in 2014 after the deposition of a pro-Russian president led to the annexation of Crimea, but also with recent events taking place along the Russia-Ukraine border. Russian-backed rebels in Ukraine have been fighting the military since the annexation, which has led to around 14,000 deaths. The reason for the hostile relations between Russia and Ukraine are not entirely clear. Many believe that it is an attempt by the Russian president to increase his sphere of influence and put Russia back to where they were on the world stage during Stalin's presidency. There is no doubt that the current president is an admirer of his predecessor, so there is a strong case for this. However, what we do know is that Russia, according to its own Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov, feels that it's absolutely mandatory to ensure that Ukraine never becomes a member of NATO, and accuses members of pumping Ukraine with weapons and stoking tensions. This does hold true, with the United States alone transferring nearly £500 million worth of weapons last year. The Russian Federation may feel that they are simply responding to the West's hostile attitudes towards them, with influence of NATO spanning across a further 14 countries, including Estonia and Latvia, which border Russia, since 1997. As of right now, the Russian Federation has surrounded Ukraine on three sides, on the Belarus, Moldova and Crimean borders, utilising up to 60 battalion groups and over 140,000 total troops, although the number of military personnel is continuing to rise. Moscow has denied that it plans to invade. However, according to defence analyst President Vladimir Putin is willing to risk real financial harm and an all-out war to achieve his political objectives over Ukraine. Standoff tactics like cruise missile test launches and cyber warfare attacks and a bit of unrest in Ukraine is likely, said Samuel Craney-Evans to CNBC. He added that Russia have deliberately assembled this situation in such a way that we will know when it is an invasion force. According to the Global Firepower IISS Military Balance Report, the Federation has three times as many troops as Ukraine and nearly 15 times as many attack aircraft. How the international community have responded will be covered later. Now, there are many questions which have been asked following these recent developments, but we want to take a closer look at the idea of security. What is security? How important could security be? And what is the impact that a possible Russian annexation of Ukraine can have on the security of Britain and on the rest of the Western world? According to Emma Rothschild, the director of the Centre for History and Economics at King's College in England, a new political interest in security emerged following the Cold War. This is the idea of seeing security in an extended sense. The first extension is the security of nations extended downwards to the security of individuals. As a result, we will be asking the British public about their opinions on the situation and whether they feel their security is at risk. We will even be speaking with a defence expert and how his feelings may differ from that of the ordinary public. The second extension is extended from the security of nations to the security of the international system and a potential supranational state. Due to this, we will be analysing the reactions across the international community and touching how any response is likely to be conducted by the European or NATO rather than just individual states placing sanctions, although the UK have announced they are prepared to do so. But before we do all this, let's look at where this all began. How did we get to a point where communist ideology was toppled by capitalism in the 1990s to a potential expansion of the Russian Federation and a huge strategical win for President Vladimir Putin's sphere of influence?
A wall has emerged in what is essentially the same historical and spiritual place. That is President Vladimir Putin's description on the situation between Russia and Ukraine. This love letter he wrote to Ukraine, titled On the Historical Unity Between Russians and Ukrainians, demonstrates an optimistic future for Ukraine when it reunites its partnership with Russia. While biased and exaggerated, Putin reminds readers of ancient Rus, where its dominant city was Kiev. That was until the Mongol invasion, which pushed them up to Moscow. but over a millennium later, Russia and Ukraine are now separate sovereign states. Putin's justification of historical links cannot be backed up, because if it were the case, the Turkish might say that they fancy the land back. After all, they did rule it in Ottoman times. Of course, there is more to the matter. Ethnic Russians in Ukraine account for 74% in Donetsk, 68% in Luhansk, and 77% in the now annexed Crimea. Russian law owns the Responsibility to Protect Act, a bill that commands Russians to protect ethnic Russians under humanitarian threat. This was what led to the annexation of Crimea and the reasoning of the unsuccessful annexations of Donetsk and Luhansk. The UN concluded that there was no such threat to ethnic Russians in these regions. And it is not unusual for Putin to have stoked these sentiments himself. John McCain supported claims that the FSB had involvement in the Chechenian bombings, which Russia used to excuse his later actions in Chechnya. Clearly, Russia or Putin is acting aggressively within the modern world order that practices diplomacy. In the 1990s, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the dispersal of the USSR was the dawn of a new era. Francis Fukuyama famously, too prematurely even, declared the end of history. Moreover, hopes that Gorbachev, Yeltsin, Gaidar would bring Russia to the liberalist world was fueled by the Washington Consensus. However, at home, these proposals of shock therapy were not so popular. Chatham House reports that the refusal of the Russian parliament to implement a lot of these government proposals effectively or at all was significant. Liberalization was only dangerous to Russia if it was without steadying the inflation, privatization, and public finances. Russia's economics in the 90s leads us here to 2022, where Russia's economy is 20% smaller than Italy's because of these failures. The problem is not that parliamentarians at the time are getting the blame from within Moscow. It is the notion of the liberal economic order that suffers. Under Putin's leadership, Russians enjoy seeing their countries face the world. And the real catalyst has been UN's popularity against it. Since the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact, all signatories bar Russia have become members. Russia argues this is too close to their borders, and if they did the same, which I suppose they did in Cuba, and the US would retaliate. Putin has clarified this position, saying in December 2021, our actions will not depend on negotiations. Any further NATO movement to the east is unacceptable. It is fair to say, in Russia's defense, that a movement which was originally created in defense against the USSR should not be expanding towards it over her old allies. And in this case, realpolitik comes to fruition. John Mearsheimer's descriptions of the primordial goal of state survival is summed up in this. Russia can be seen to be standing up against the encroachment of the NATO and the EU. And in addition, if Ukraine has populations of ethnic Russians, it would be irrational to ignore them in Ukraine. Russia is in a strong position to stand up for itself because it is seeking to become a regional hegemony. The weight it throws within the gas industry makes experts fear exponential gas prices and disappearances of fertilizer causing untold famine. If we run through events, we can see how Russia has thrown its weight around. From the Orange Revolution in 2004, when Lukashenko was put in place instead of the pro-Russian president, and to suspicions of electoral fraud, to the then 2008 NATO statement offering membership to Ukraine and Georgia, leading to the Georgian uprising subsequently being quashed by Russian forces. 2014 saw the annexation of Crimea, and Putin's approval ratings at home went up to 80%, according to The Guardian. 2016 saw Ukraine in a deep and comprehensive trade deal with the EU, and 2017, the Ukraine set a roadmap for EU membership. From these failures to economics, expansion of NATO, the passivity of gas, the Ukraine has been in the perilous fate of Russia's actions and the West's reactions. The current amalgamation of troops has been a long time coming, since the economic failures and the enjoyment of Russian expansionism by the Russian population.
Having looked at the current situation in the Ukraine and in Russia, and then analysing the history behind everything, we decided to sit down with a defence expert and a specialist in security to ask him why he thinks that Britain has to get involved and why Britain is taking a much more strict stance compared to the rest of the EU.
Okay, so I think basically there are sort of three factors at play here. The first one is history. So in 1994, the UK, along with Russia and the US, committed to respecting Ukraine's sovereignty and its independence, and to provide assistance if it was at threat from risk of an act of aggression, effectively. And those promises were made in exchange for Ukraine giving up its nuclear arsenal. So I think that's kind of, we have a historical obligation, and that seems to be kind of playing through quite a lot at the moment. I think also geographically, Ukraine is really not that far from NATO allies, to whom the UK has, obligations to under Article 5 of the NATO treaty. And so, not allowing or not helping Ukraine potentially risks the security of those countries that we do have a legal obligation to. And I think, when you look at those countries, so Poland, the Baltics, for example, they're all particularly concerned about Russia's behaviour of the last few years. And so we potentially undermine collective deterrence if we're not seen to be helping at least a country that we might not have legal duties and responsibilities to. But it doesn't say a lot to the countries that we do have those responsibilities to if we're not seen to be helping. I think the second point really is that we've got capability. So unlike a lot of other countries, perhaps in NATO, the UK actually has both the means and the political will to support Ukraine on top of its legal responsibilities too. And so obviously we've seen that quite recently with the export of some NLAWs, so anti-tank systems, to Ukraine. And that's on top of the fact that, we've got a military training mission, Operation Orbital, in Ukraine already, and that's already trained 18,000 Ukrainian service personnel. And on top of all of those things, we're going to be helping the Ukrainians to beef up their navy as well and replace some of the ships that the Russians basically kind of kidnapped and stole off them during the annexation of Crimea. And like a lot of NATO countries or EU countries might not have either the capability or necessarily the political will to. So we've seen Germany, for example, blocking efforts by Estonia to re-export some German manufactured equipment to Ukraine. They've been offering equipment, things like helmets, for example, rather than any kind of lethal equipment. And so I think that's why we're able to sort of be a bit more assertive. And I think the final thing really is the intelligence picture. I think the UK, the US and Canada, through Five Eyes, for example, have been most forward-leaning when it comes to offering aid to Ukraine, and that possibly represents the fact that they have intelligence that suggests that the threat of invasion or kind of further armed conflict is higher than other countries do. You know, look at the fact that the US was looking at evacuating diplomats' families. Why would they be doing that if they didn't suspect that there was actually a reasonable kind of threat to life?
With the tensions growing steadily, let's take a quick look at some of the reactions from the international community. So what can be seen here actually is a lot of significant effort to promote de-escalation from Russia. On Thursday, Poland adopted a resolution condemning the actions of Russia's buildup of military. They appealed to NATO and EU countries to extend their support to Ukraine during these times. Poland also maintains that membership to NATO and the EU should still be an option to Ukraine should they want to pursue this in the future. The United States also had a strong reaction to the Russian military illegally bordering eastern Ukraine. President Joe Biden actually declared that the US would take a direct role in the diplomacy of the afflicted region. He claims that this is an attempt to de-escalate Russia and dissuade from the threat of invasion. To the relief of many Americans, he has stated that deploying American troops to the scene would not be an option this time. Instead, he is threatening economic sanctions on Russia. To date, the US and NATO have formally rejected Russia's demand on the nature of halting NATO expansion. They claim that their condition, Russia's condition, of never admitting Ukraine into NATO is non-negotiable. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has also said that the US's written response to Russia sets out a serious diplomatic path forward and that all Russia has to do is choose it. The UK is supplying Ukraine with short tank missiles and troops for self-defense and training purposes. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has publicly stated that the UK will not tolerate the destabilizing activities shown by Russia. He has also publicly condemned the action of Russia, reminding us that no one would gain from such a catastrophe. He's also claimed that Russia would create a wasteland in the country of Ukraine. But despite sending military reinforcements, the UK's stance is still one of honest diplomacy. Alongside this, Johnson has publicly stated that they have sought to combine dialogue with deterrence, emphasizing how a united Western alliance would extract a large price for Russia should they choose to invade Ukraine. This price includes heavy sanctions from the West. Less severe actions have come from the Canadian Foreign Ministry, which has announced a temporary withdrawal of any non-essential Canadian employees from the embassy in Ukraine. Similar action has been taken by the likes of the US and the UK. Alongside this, NATO has a history of dependency on Russia for gas supplies, which leaves it slightly more vulnerable in this standoff, because any sanctions it places on Russia may face harsh retaliation of the weaponized gas supplies. So, in the meantime, NATO allies have agreed to work on diversifying their supplies and looking for short-term goals to reduce their dependency. In my opinion, one of the most shocking reactions came from Ukraine itself. In contrast to the West, Ukraine was seemingly downplaying the danger that the Russian invasion threatens. In response to the strong efforts of the West, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called on the West to remain calm in spite of any suspicions directed towards Russia's plans to invade his own country. During a news conference for foreign media, he said that there are no tanks, no army men in the street, despite the impression that the media has given the world. He went on to assure that there is no need for panic and his main aim is to stabilize the economy. This response came after the US and NATO rejected Moscow's demands for security guarantees in Europe, which, albeit, created quite a lot of heat and tension within the international realm. almost in direct contrast to their government, the citizens of Ukraine have made it very clear that they are very ready to fight, despite Russia having upward of 1 million people in the armed forces, which is four more times than Ukraine's force strength. In an interview, a local army commander was blunt about the fate that awaits the people. He said he's talking about the Russians. He said they will get a warm reception with plenty of coffins, which pretty much summarizes the citizens of Ukraine's views on this. Another large question that surfaces from this situation is, what effect does the threat of Ukraine pose for the international community? Former senior director of Europe and Russia at the United States Security Council, Fiona Hill, she warns of a precedent setting in. She claims that the situation should be of great concern to all of the countries, because what stops other countries from doing the same to their neighbor? Currently, Russia has placed around 100,000 troops on the eastern border of Ukraine, and she discusses the threat of a third world war. She highlights that this is exactly the sort of situation we fought two world wars against. So overall, there seems to be a united approach to diplomacy for de-escalation, and the strong belief is held that Ukraine should have the doors open for NATO membership. There's also a cause for concern that this threat goes beyond just a spat between Russia and Ukraine and the US. It's a much bigger challenge than it looks, and it will prove to be an international game changer.
With the international response being so varied, so unpredictable, and potentially extremely concerning, we asked our defence specialist and our security expert about how
the US and the UK have been warned by Russia that they would pay a heavy price if they, got involved. I read that on the Sky News. What do you think they mean by this?
So I think when you look at some of the foreign secretary's recent comments, I think there's a reasonable chance that some of the measures we might be looking to take next would probably include some targeted sanctions on Putin himself and probably those closest to him. I think that the slight issue here might be the fact that, any of those sanctions are likely to take months to have an actual realistic impact. And if Putin believes that he can achieve his sort of military objectives before those sanctions have any impact, then what's the benefit of having those implemented? Of course, they will eventually hurt, but if he's already achieved his outcomes, in exchange for de-escalating the situation, he might then ask that those sanctions be removed in order to reach an accommodation with the West on, finding some kind of compromise and sort of enter any kind of conflict that might break out. So I think that's the kind of thing that we're likely to see. But Russia is already really heavily sanctioned country, so it's quite difficult to think of what's left on the table to actually, kind of have any meaningful impact on that front.
So do you think if the UK almost did more, because Europe and the UK are a bit reliant on gas from Russia, do you think that could affect us at all, in retaliation almost?
It could well do. And I think, on that front, on the energy security front, that's perhaps why Germany particularly has not been able to or not willing to take a particularly hard line towards Russia. So, for example, when you looked at, the Americans considering maybe kicking Russia out of SWIFT, the international kind of payment system, the Germans were coming out and saying, no, perhaps this wasn't the kind of route to go down, only sending very limited defensive equipment to the Ukrainians, that kind of thing. I think there's a good chance. And I think, if we look at the way Russia operates, they are willing to try and use some of these routes as to exploit and kind of divide, the EU or the NATO alliance. And I think that's perhaps where the UK has a benefit. We're not as reliant on Russian kind of oil and gas supplies. And that actually gives us the kind of flexibility and the ability to kind of take that on the chin and, gives us a bit of policy flexibility that other countries don't necessarily have.
Do you think that's maybe why we're taking a bit more of a harsher stance compared to like other European countries?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, when we look at Russia and its behaviour, for us, we've seen an uptick and it's been noted in the news in, Russian submarine activity in the North Sea, for example. you know, and the risk that that could have, you know, in terms of the risk that it might, they might be looking to kind of sever, you know, underwater sea cables, which are really, you know, critical to the lifeblood of, you know, any major economy, because that's where all of our information has been transmitted through, you know, thousands of, you know, economic transactions and bits and pieces, intelligence and all the rest of it. So I think we see ourselves in a position where we're having to kind of counter Russia on two fronts, in the north, really through kind of anti-submarine warfare, and then obviously in terms of supporting NATO in a kind of land domain in the east.
I know that we've put some troops over there. Do you think we're going to like be directly involved if there is any conflict, or are we going to take more of like a stance on like staying away and like sending help over through like supplies and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think we're quite unlikely to see the UK actually deploying combat troops to Ukraine. Primarily because Ukraine is not a NATO country. The UK doesn't have any treaty obligations to physically defend Ukraine. So I think we'll probably see all the steps up to that point. But that isn't to say that we wouldn't considering, as we have already, you know, deploying additional troops and resources to NATO, like bordering NATO countries. So Poland is a good example. I think that's probably more likely the line we're kind of likely to kind of go down. Because, you know, what would be the premise and of, you know, of actually kind of having a fighting role in Ukraine, on what basis would we be doing so?
With all this being said, we turn to the British public, their thoughts. Do they care? Are they worried?
No, I don't think I'm scared. Russia has exhibited aggressive behaviour before, and I think in this time, the level of diplomacy will mean that there won't be an invasion.
Elizabeth will be going through a pandemic and a war at the same time.
Definitely. It's quite a serious situation.
Do you think our government should do anything, or like, what would you want them to do about the situation?
They need to be tough on Russia.
Okay.
They need to be very tough on Russia, and they need to work with they need to work with NATO, with the US, and stand up to Russia.
I think they should gauge why the Russians are quite so defensive over NATO. Of course, it's a battle of ideologies, as has been historically present. I believe that the UK should not play a major role in this, but I think they should be a force of liaison between NATO as an organisation and Russia.
Do you want our government to do it?
Yeah, probably.
What should they do?
We started the programme discussing how security had expanded both upwards and to mean more than just the security of a single nation. We analysed how differences in ideology have led to the West fearing for their security in the face of the Russian Federation, showing how this has not just developed out of thin air. The reactions by the international community to Russia's ever-growing presence around the Ukrainian border suggests that this feeling of hostility and fear is being experienced by other governments too. We even spoke with a defence and security expert who strongly believes that the situation is a cause for concern. Yet, the majority of the British public who we seem to have a chat with did not have this same level of fear. Is it just the lion heart within us? Is it the belief that Britain will always prevail? Or will the British soon come to realise that this is not just another crisis for us to care of? Rather, it is the crisis which could last a generation and have much deeper consequences than the Cold War ever did. That was Tariq Ahmed, Ashley Bluedawn, Kit Clayton and Annalise Wicks on Is Our Security at Risk? And we'll be sure to keep you updated on the situation as it develops on The Politics Show. Now, I am delighted to introduce you to the wonderful Ashley Bluedawn, who is heading up a new segment on the show called Borisgate, where we keep you up to date on the Prime Minister's current position. Will he stay or will he go? So, Ashley, tell me, what's going on with the Prime Minister today?
Well, I believe that we're all waiting for the results of the Sue Gray inquiry on Partygate right now, which will ultimately determine the fate of our Prime Minister. So if you're not fully aware of what this is, it's an investigation into the alleged parties which hosted a number of MPs and Boris Johnson himself. The parties broke the current social distancing rules that were in place at the time, and the government at the time was also encouraging restraint from the public. So whether or not the full report will be published or not has not been confirmed yet, but Labour Party is demanding that it is being published in full, including all the names of the attendees of the parties. Many families who had members who passed and they were not able to see their loved ones feel very strongly that they have the right to know the full truth from their Prime Minister. I'm sure many will agree that it was a struggle to be away from their loved ones at that time, even if there was a good reason.
And in terms of the Prime Minister's sort of situation right now, how likely is he to resign?
Well, the future for Johnson staying on the role does look a little bit bleak right now. There have been multiple MPs, that, including the Labour leader, Sir Keir Starmer, that have called on Johnson to resign. Starmer actually accused him of breaking the ministerial code by denying the parties and misleading the parliament. Dominic Raab also confirmed this too when he was questioned. He said that if Johnson had deliberately lied and had not corrected himself immediately, it would normally be a resigning matter under the ministerial code. And perhaps it's actually in the best interest of his own party for Johnson to resign. According to data polls, they show that 68% of the British public opinion on the MP has on the Prime Minister has worsened, and 80% of all the Brits say that they now trust the Prime Minister and the government way less than before.
So it seems like the polls are suggesting that the people want the Prime Minister to go. It seems like that's what the Dominic Raab is also suggesting as well, that potentially that could happen. So in terms of sort of, where did this all begin? Because it started off with a majority government in 2019. Boris was on a great start. And then now it seems like he's out the door.
That's actually a really good question, because like you said, it was a great start for Boris Johnson. And currently, right now, only a quarter of the Brits feel that Boris Johnson should remain as Prime Minister. So I think that public opinion soured a lot with the government's wishy-washy handling of the pandemic. But the nail in the coffin was the multiple parties. The exact slide into what seems like no return for the Prime Minister, it actually started when the party was reported by media outlets such as the Daily Mirror, but then the allegations started to get really serious when former number 10 aide Dominic Cummings, he came out and all but confirmed the party. He said that multiple journalists were there and reminded that it was very unwise to lie about the parties, which even to date, the Prime Minister continues to deny were a breach of lockdown rules. I've spoken to a former student who was caught hosting parties last year, and we sat down. I asked him what had happened.
Oh, yeah. So I got fined twice while I was at uni. And this was both in my third year of uni after being at uni for 4 years. So that wasn't great.
If you don't mind me asking, how much did you get fined?
So I got fined, I think, around £500 or £600. I'm not entirely sure because this was taken off my deposit. It was taken off all our deposits, actually, because I wasn't the only one who had to pay the fine. It was just my flatmates and I. And I lived in a townhouse, and we were around 10 people. So what happened was, at the time, the COVID rules were you can have a party in your house and everything, but it has to be everyone that lives in the house.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a party, and some of my friends invited some of the other friends that don't live with us. And campus security came, and when they came, they realized that they checked our campus our student numbers, and they realized that some people don't live with us, and then they fined us.
Mm-hmm. So students are known to have these very active social lives. When you were a student, did you find that it was harder to keep up with the lockdown rules, or do you think it's harder for students than to keep up with the lockdown rules more so than the average public?
Yeah, I mean, I believe the social aspect of uni is a very big part of the culture, because this is something that everyone who is going to uni or anyone who is in uni looks up to. And I feel like for someone like me, for example, who has been used to this social life of always going out, always being with my friends, like an instant stop isn't the best feeling. I think people would always tend to break this kind of rules.
Because you spent first year without any lockdown rules, so it must have been a big difference.
Yes, so for me, I had my first year where I could make friends with people, friends with my course. I'm still friends with people friends I made at uni. But other people who had to sadly come into uni at this time, work with COVID, couldn't make friends as well as I did. I don't think they might struggle to currently with making friends now because they didn't have the chance to do that in their first year.
So do you think these lockdown rules have definitely made it a lot harder for students to make these friends and settle into a new environment?
Oh yeah, definitely, because I feel like human beings in general, we're very social creatures. So if you take that away from us, it's really, really hard for us to adapt.
As someone who uses social media a lot, or just generally keeps up with the news, are you aware of the Partygate inquiry?
Oh yeah, so I mean, I wouldn't consider myself someone who generally keeps up with the news, but I remember seeing a couple memes on Instagram, actually, of Boris Johnson and his whole situation with the... Yeah, but I did see Boris Johnson and his MPs in doing having a garden party, and I don't know where that came from, because I believe we're all meant to be in lockdown when that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this was a general snub to the... I think this was a snub to the general public, because I know some people who couldn't see their families over the holidays, especially seeing my family. For me, especially, I couldn't travel back to Nigeria because of the lockdown rules. And I feel like this wasn't fair, especially from some other people who had a family who was sick and they couldn't see them. And Boris was out there throwing parties, and that's not great, is it?
I understand. So 500 can actually be a debilitating amount of money to some students.
Definitely.
Yeah, especially if like they haven't fully entered the job market yet and they're within that age bracket. As someone that's been on the receiving end of the lockdown laws, how do the actions of the members of government make you feel? How do their recent actions make you personally feel?
Personally, I think this was very... came off very hypocritical, because it felt like there was one set of rules for the elites and another set of rules for the general public. And this seems very unfair, because to us, it seems like they're above the law.
So you believe that the government not only has the responsibility to set these laws, but to also lead and follow these, lead by example as well?
Definitely. Yeah, so I don't think anyone's above the law. No president, no prime minister. Doesn't matter what your status is in society. I feel like everyone should obey the law.
Thank you very much. That was Ashley Bluedawn giving us the update on the Prime Minister's current situation. Now, you might not know this. Well, you should know this, because, of course, you're such an active listener to The Politics Show, but we are based at the University of Reading. Now, university, it's all fun and games until it's time to step into the world of work. Jeez, I'm definitely not ready for that, but don't worry, because Annalise Wicks is going to tell us all about how we can get ready to enter the big, wide world and that crazy competitive job market.
Thanks, Tarek. Well, the latest monthly unemployment figures have shown young people and graduates to be the hardest hit by the economic fallout of the pandemic, with two-thirds of young people accounting for job losses since. Between 2019 and 2020, unemployment rose from 10% to 13.3% among graduates, a 33% increase. This has been exacerbated by the fact that graduates are not protected by the furlough scheme, alongside companies, as a consequence, slashing their graduate schemes. With many entry-level roles wanting a year or two of experience, it's becoming increasingly difficult for young people to actually get into these positions, especially if there are fewer opportunities to gain experience being offered. How can they win? They're stuck between a rock and a hard place, really. I sat down with a defence expert who recently graduated to ask him for advice on how he prepared for post-degree life.
So I wasn't very organised. I think that's the first point to emphasise. So I had imagined and talked about throughout my time at uni that I was going to apply for the fast stream, the civil service fast stream.
Okay.
And I literally got to January 2017 and was like, great, time to crack on and apply. Failed to recognise that the applications had actually closed in September 2016. So yeah. I wasn't very organised, and I thought, oh God, you know, really... that was the one thing I was kind of banking on, and I've screwed it up. I did a bit of a panic master's, really. Did it part-time to try and give myself time to, A, afford the rest of it, because, you know, the student loan doesn't quite stretch to what the degree cost, but also to try and get an internship or bits and pieces to try and get myself some work experience, basically. Yeah. So I don't know if I was necessarily worried, but I gave myself a couple of extra years to try and get into a good position to be employable. But actually, you know, I managed to find a job, the job I applied for first in about April 2018, and, you know, yeah, and then from there, I kind of managed to get started. So, yeah.
Amazing. Okay, so I'll go on to the questions that I've written down. What would your advice be to students, even first and second years, who want to do well at university, and also for any advice on preparing for their life after university?
I think one general piece of advice, which will just carry you through pre or, you know, during and after uni, is definitely just make the most of the opportunities that you've got. You know, first and second year, you know, you don't have a lot of contact hours. You have, you know, a reasonable amount of work, but not a huge amount, I don't think, necessarily. But you have made like loads and loads of opportunities to do loads of interesting stuff. So, you know, definitely try and get onto modules that, you know, take your interest, but also are going to give you interesting skills. So, you know, the media and politics modules are a great one, you know, getting to interview people, preparing a broadcast, finding people to you know, have discussions with, all really useful stuff and really interesting things to be able to talk about at an interview or in a CV, because it's something kind of unusual. Learn a language, go on, you know, study abroad, you know, look for opportunities to do stuff, whether that's, you know, supporting, you know, a politics lecture, you know, extracurricular lecture where there's a speaker coming in. You know, is there something you can do in terms of supporting that, in terms of like a little project to manage perhaps? So, you know, you're in a safe environment at uni. The risks of, you know, associated with, you know, failure, whatever that looks like, are really, really low. So there's nothing to be lost by just chancing your arm and throwing yourself into these things. And, you know, someone who can come out of uni and say they didn't just do the course, they didn't just do the bare minimum, they didn't just get a 2-1, they did, you know, they got their 2-1 and they did, you know, X, Y, and Z. And that's going to make you, you know, what is going to make you stand out on an interview? What is going to make someone go, this person's got something about them that's worth kind of looking into, or having a conversation about or bringing to interview? Because like you say, you know, you are up against potentially, you know, hundreds of people who have very similar degrees, have very similar interests, very similar backgrounds. But what is it that's going to make you stand out from the pack? So, you know, when you're in those first 2 years, don't squander your time, because it's brilliant fun, if anything else. It's just really good stuff to do. But yeah, that's going to, you know, I think put you in a better position.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really good advice, actually. I haven't heard that yet. Let me just go into the next one. Well, I remember you just mentioning saying that you didn't really apply for many post-grad opportunities while at university. So maybe asking the question, how do you balance your degree while applying for post-grad opportunities, isn't the best. Would you recommend doing that and like looking around while you're still at uni doing your degree?
Yeah, I would definitely recommend again, you know, you've got career advisors, you've got access to your lecturers and things like that. Just having these conversations, have them early. You know, there's never really too early to start thinking about them, because you might think, well, actually, you know, if I have a conversation in first year and then I might be able to find an internship or something like that to do between first and second year, and that builds you contacts and experience, you know, and it might not lead to a job per se, but again, it just gives you an awareness of an area, right? You know, you go and spend 2 months working over summer at your local radio station, and it gives you an interest of, well, actually, you know, is broadcast journalism something I'm really interested in? Yes or no? But it doesn't matter, because it's experience, you know, and you can say that you put yourself out there and you didn't lounge around for 2 months, that you were proactive and you were looking at stuff. I would say just don't panic. That's the big one. Don't you think that, you know, just because you missed that particular opportunity or whatever, you know, because especially when you get into, I think what people don't appreciate is that job hunting is difficult, and you are going to apply for loads of stuff and you are not going to hear from a lot of them. You're going to get told no by the rest that do apply. And then like one or two, you might get into. And I don't think people necessarily realize that, you know, the amount of time and effort, it is a job to get a job.
yeah.
So
yeah.
So just kind of being realistic and like, don't get too emotionally invested in things, or too upset if you don't get the result you wanted, you know?
Yeah.
But if people do come back and say, no, you didn't get it, try and be positive, try and get some feedback on, you know, where did I go wrong? Was it just I didn't have enough experience? And, you know, that gives a bit of a pointer. You know, because I know that most of the time they say we're not giving feedback, but if you're tenacious and that one person out of 100 who actually tries to make an effort to get some feedback, they might indulge you and give you some. And that, yeah, you know, that can be a real benefit.
Yeah. So my last question is, in terms of using your degree for jobs, how would you make it fit with various opportunities that come up?
So I think actually politics is a really interesting one on this one, because of course you've got the subject matter itself, but most people who do politics are not obviously going to end up as politicians. Otherwise we'd probably be in a much worse place than we already are. But it does give you a really fantastic, you know, basis in terms of skills and, you know, opportunities that are basically applicable to pretty much any job I think you're ever going to apply for. I mean, if you think back on it, you know, most jobs want someone who can use Microsoft Office. Most jobs want someone who's got good verbal and written skills, and people who are confident, you know, making an argument, presenting, you know, whether that's in a sales environment, making a pitch, or, you know, in front of ministers briefing them, you know, it's the same set of skills. And actually, when you think about your time at Reading, you will have had an opportunity to basically improve all of these skills over that time. You know, you might have also had opportunities to, you know, group tasks, which is an opportunity to, you know, demonstrate your leadership skills, or, you know, your just ability to work with other people. And of course, you know, throughout your essays and, you know, presentations, bits and pieces, you'll have to make an argument, you know, whether that's written or verbal. And those are all definitely useful skills as well. But of course, you know, if you're interested in the public sector or even working in politics in some kind of capacity, then obviously the content of the degree itself is not going to do you any harm at all. So I think, you will probably find that as a sort of a generalist in terms of skills and bits and pieces, you know, politics is going to put you in a good place going into most roles, I'd imagine.
Thank you very much. That was Annalise Wick sitting down with a defence and security expert discussing all things graduation. So, Annalise, in terms of what University of Reading students can do to improve their career prospects, can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, Tarek, you don't have to look far to see that the university offers so many opportunities that can boost your CV and give an edge over other graduates in the workforce. The careers department provides weekly online workshops led by professionals just for you. Over this term, the topics discussed will include business writing, confidence, leadership skills, networking, and so much more. If you want to get involved, the next one up is on Monday the 7th and is on how to network with purpose. The Reading Experience and Development Award, that you've probably heard of, also known as the Red Award, is an official employability skills certificate that you can sign up to through the university. It will help you to stand out from the crowd by encouraging you to make the most of extracurricular activities and experiences outside your academics by signposting to employers that you've gone beyond your degree. You might even be doing these things anyway, so why not have a qualification to show for it? Even more, the Reading Internship Scheme provides 4 to 6 to 8 week paid internships, exclusive to Reading students. Among giving job experience, it can create a professional network as well as boosting your resume to make it as strong as possible. If these aren't for you, or you're still confused about what you're doing after university, another one is the Thrive Mentoring Scheme. It can pair your professionals in your field to talk you through your career plans and aspirations, hopefully helping you to prepare and think about your post-graduation life. If all of this is a bit overwhelming, which it often is, speak to your academic tutor. I'm sure they'll be able to point you in the right direction, or head over to My Jobs Online.
Thank you very much, Annalise. Lots of things to get involved there. Well, we're over halfway through our show. What a show, delightful show it has been as well. But don't worry, because we still have our question of the week coming up. But right now, it's Kit Clayton giving you the lowdown on everything happening in and around Reading over the course of the next week.
Yes, that's right. Reading is looking at quite the exciting pool of activities. This evening, the cultural show takes place in the 360. Tickets are cheap, so don't let them fly from you. On Tuesday, the Pakistan Society meet and greet gathers at 6 p.m. in Monterey. And that all leads us to the RUSU elections, which students can look forward to campaigning from candidates later this month.
Kit, tell me a bit more about how those elections work. You know, how do you vote? How do students get involved with that?
Well, while the nomination period is now closed, you can still immerse yourself in the elections. Voting takes place from the 22nd to the 25th of February. And after a good week of campaigning, I expect you'll all want to look out for the candidates as the elections determine a number of full-time officers. These include the president, who oversees RUSU and engages in events with other unis, and the education officer, who keeps your curriculum stimulating and up to date. On top of this, part-time officer roles are being fought for. These you can consider to be the equivalent of a role that an MP might play, as they work on specific issues and influence the big movers above them, the full-time officers, who, you could say, are the equivalent to the cabinet ministers. But of course, both roles are equally important, and they are all in your hands. As we've mentioned before, the staff walkouts planned for roughly the same period mean Reading Uni has plenty of democratic practices going on, which is good considering the wider picture of the uni world that we have just discussed. But I want to surprise you with some more good news, particularly with the app for actors, producers and even builders, as there is progress within the Winners Triangle, not far from Reading, where we can expect to see a huge expansion of its film studios. We're looking at 50,000 square feet of office space, and by the end of 2022, the studios will include the world's largest virtual production stage and the same technology that has replaced green screens, which was used in Venom, one of the Mandalorian films. So plenty of positive news in Reading.
Thank you very much, Kit Clayton, there with everything going on in and around Reading. We've got a few minutes remaining, so the question of the week today is an interesting one. Now, apparently, most people don't stick to their New Year's resolutions. I know, shocking. So I want to ask you and everyone in the studio, what was their New Year's resolutions and have they stuck to them? Kit, I'm going to start off with you.
Yes, so I've been trying to read some books and I've got quite a few gathered on my shelf gathering dust. But... the French hasn't gone so well either. Hopefully some other people have some positive news.
Annalise, go on, give me some positive news about your New Year's resolutions.
So my resolution was to pack my lunches before coming onto campus so I didn't spend as much money on Bagel Man. This has gone mostly well, apart from the fact that I've just come from eating a bagel before coming into the studio.
Oh, that was poor from you, Annalise. Ashley, come on, give me some solid news.
I would love to give it to you, but I also failed my New Year's resolutions. Oh. Mine was I wanted to stop eating and buying takeout to teach myself how to cook. But considering that I just went with Annalise to Bagel King, I don't think it's happening.
Disappointing from the studio. Mine was to run a half marathon. It's going well so far, but I definitely need to lay off the takeaway as well. And that is all we have time for on this week's episode of The Politics Show, where we covered the ever-changing status of Britain's security amidst the international crisis along the Ukrainian border, introduced a new segment called Boris Gate, discussing whether the Prime Minister will stay or go. We received some great tips on how to prepare to enter the job market and heard about everything going on in and around Reading. Be sure to let us know whether you've stuck to your New Year's resolutions, and if you have, the studio could definitely do with some tips. From everyone here in the studio, Ashley Bluedorn, Kit Clayton, Annalise Witt, and your host, Tariq Ahmed. Goodbye for now. We'll see you next week.